you and I would think armadillos are attractive, not just cute in an offbeat way, but deeply enticing. You might have trouble controlling your urge to caress them. Alert drivers on country roads in Texas might screech to a halt every now and then for an impromptu armadillo liaison. And needless to say, there would be no moral transgression more grave than killing an innocent armadillo. It's tempting to dismiss such evolutionary hypotheticals as meaningless. Sure, if fruits were toxic to our species and dirt was packed with carbohydrates, then nobody would have a sweet tooth, and the great dieting challenge would be to control your dirt tooth. But so what? We've always known that some things, what tastes good, what qualifies as sexy, are subjective. So the question of what foods and mates are attractive isn't really a question of thinking something is true that isn't really true. Nobody thinks Coke is better than Pepsi in the sense that 4 is greater than 3. Actually, I'm not so sure about that. I've seen people argue about what constitutes great wine or great art, as if convinced they were really right and the other person was wrong. That's the thing about feelings, a thing that is particularly true when we talk about their role in shaping essence. They can render judgment so subtly that we don't realize that it's the feelings that are rendering the judgment. We think the judgment is objective. When I see a Ferrari and feel essence of exotic, pricey sports car, I don't think, but this is just the opinion of one particular member of one particular species, because the perception is too subtle to even register as a full-fledged opinion. More consequentially, when I see in the driver essence of rich show-off, I probably won't discount that judgment either, because, again, I probably won't be reflective enough to realize it's a judgment. It feels more like a simple fact. That's the way the perception of essence works. It smuggles judgments into our mind by cloaking them in feelings that are themselves so subtle, or at least so routine, as to often escape conscious recognition. And these feelings, these elementary ingredients of perceived essence, are by their nature tied to a particular perspective, the perspective of a species, or, as in the Ferrari case, the perspective of an individual within that species. From the perspective that Einstein considered the truest perspective, the point of view from no particular point, feelings don't even exist, and so essence doesn't either. Again, I'm not encouraging you to let go of the entire repertoire of feelings and thoughts that is the heritage of our evolutionary lineage. Your bias toward snake evasion is understandable, if staying alive is high on your list of priorities, as I think it should be. Still, suppose, just a thought experiment, that your goal wasn't living as long as possible, but rather attaining the clearest vision possible. Suppose you wanted to view life on this planet, and reality in general, from some perspective less parochial than the perspective of any one species. Suppose you wanted to view it from some more objective, more transcendent, more universally true perspective. Then you would want to look at a snake without the emotional biases of any species, without the fear and aversion and dislike that comes naturally to a human, and without the lust that comes naturally to a snake's paramour. You'd want to look at a swamp from the standpoint of neither a human nor a mosquito. You'd want to view reality with none of the feelings that evolved in our species or any other species as a way to get genes into the next generation. You'd want, like Einstein, the view from nowhere in particular. The point of view of the universe. The phrase, the view from nowhere, is famously associated with the philosopher Thomas Nagel, who made it the title of a book. The book wasn't about Buddhism. It was about the whole nature of knowing and about the mission of philosophy. And that includes moral philosophy. For example, is there such a thing as an objectivity so complete that you could address moral issues bearing on your own interests without any bias at all? This degree of moral objectivity would be one important, some would say, the most important, consequence of attaining enlightenment. And it may be that, given the nature of the human mind, the only way to fully realize this moral dimension of Buddhist enlightenment would be to realize the other dimensions, the metaphysical ones, to experientially apprehend the truth of, most notably, not self and emptiness. Maybe to get the moral view from nowhere, you need the complete view from nowhere. In any event, the view from nowhere may be the pithiest way of describing what Buddhist enlightenment would be like, the view that carries none of my selfish biases or yours, and that, in a certain sense, isn't even a particularly human perspective or the perspective of any other species. This, truly, would be a view that defied natural selection's authority, because natural selection is all about specific perspectives. It is about creating lots and lots of different perspectives, each of which is shaped fundamentally by the principle that it is truer than competing perspectives, and none of which is naturally imbued with awareness of that fact, much less awareness of its absurdity. Buddhist enlightenment is about transcending all these perspectives. The view from nowhere, the view of impartiality, shouldn't be confused with a view of indifference. The view from nowhere can, and I'd argue should, involve concern for the well-being of all people, and if we're going to be true to Buddhist teaching and to fairly straightforward moral logic, concern for the well-being of all sentient beings. The point is just that the concern would be evenly distributed. No one's welfare is more important than anyone else's. If the view from nowhere sounds like an overly negative way of describing this sort of benevolent transcendence, you could use the phrase coined by the 19th century moral philosopher Henry Sidgwick when he alluded to the self-evident principle that the good of any one individual is of no more importance from the point of view, if I may say so, of the universe than the good of any other. Regardless of your preferred terminology, view from nowhere, point of view of the universe, the upshot is the same. Our ordinary point of view, the one we're naturally endowed with, is seriously misleading. So yes, we can think of natural selection as somewhat like those robot overlords in The Matrix, perpetrating a pervasive and oppressive illusion on behalf of an agenda that we have every right to reject. If looking at things this way helps give you the determination it takes to sustain a serious meditation practice, by all means, look at things this way. At the same time, it is in the spirit of Buddhism to be skeptical of demonizing anyone or anything. So let me say a few kind words about natural selection. It did create sentient life, and sentient life can be a wonderful thing. Indeed, the bliss that is said to be a part of true enlightenment wouldn't be possible without sentience. Neither would the more modest growth of happiness that can be had with more modest progress along the meditative path. You might even say that sentience is what gives life meaning and makes it a matter of moral concern. Certainly, Buddhism's moral emphasis on respect for sentient beings wouldn't make much sense if there weren't any sentient beings around. In that sense, Buddhism and natural selection would seem to be on the same page. Sentient life is a good thing. But if natural selection indeed holds sentient life in high esteem, it's got a funny way of showing it. After all, the creation of complex life has involved the premature death of lots of living things, things judged genetically inferior by natural selection, not to mention tons of violence and suffering. That is why the specialness of self is such a strong intuition. For our ancestors, it was often either them or the other guy, and genes that encouraged them to think the other guy was as important as they were wouldn't have gone anywhere. So the sense of specialness and the attendant baggage of self, whatever you think of them, were unavoidable features of sentient life so long as life was created by natural selection. And be honest, if you had to choose between a planet full of living things that consider themselves special and a planet as barren as Mars, you'd choose the former, right? I would. Yes, barrenness can be beautiful, but if there are no sentient beings, the beauty goes unappreciated and even, in a sense, unrealized. But here's the unfortunate paradox. We've gotten to a point in human history when the sense of specialness could actually endanger the continued flourishing of sentient life. I said in Chapter 2 that I'd spare you the full-length, high-volume version of my sermon about saving the planet, about how the psychology of tribalism threatens to break people apart along religious, national, ethnic, and ideological lines, and I'm a man of my word. Still, it's worth spending a few paragraphs conveying the cosmic context of this prospect, viewing the crossroads we stand at against the backdrop of the whole history of life. A brief history of life. For 4 billion years, life on this planet has been ascending to higher and higher levels of organization. First, there were just bare, self-replicating strands of information. Then they encased themselves in cells. Then some of these cells got together and formed multicellular organisms. Then some of these organisms developed complex brains, and some species of brainy organisms became highly social. One species of social, brainy organism was so social and brainy that it launched a whole second kind of evolution, cultural evolution, the evolution of ideas and customs and technologies. And this second kind of evolution carried the species to higher and higher levels of social organization, from hunter-gatherer village to ancient state to empire and so on, until here we are, on the brink of establishing a cohesive global society. As if to underscore what a natural outgrowth of biological and cultural evolution this is, there is even a kind of emerging global brain, the Internet, animated by the human brains that form its neurons. If you saw all this from outer space and in time-lapse, so that billions of years were compressed into minutes, it might seem like you were watching the growth and maturation of a single planetary organism. Indeed, this growth might seem driven by such powerful developmental logic that the continued congealing of that organism, that is, the emergence of a peaceful and orderly global civilization, was inevitable. You'd be wrong about the inevitable part. That's the whole problem. But it's true that the logic behind the process has been powerful. For starters, natural selection is so wildly inventive that the advent of a species smart enough to launch cultural evolution was probably pretty likely all along. The subsequent expansion of our species' social organization, from hunter-gatherer village all the way to globalization, was also likely, because cultural evolution, like biological evolution, has a powerful creative engine behind it. At least, that's the case I made in a book called Non-Zero. I argued that, ever since the Stone Age, the expansion of human social organization has been impelled by a technologically driven growth in the range of interdependence. Over time, people at farther and farther distances from one another have come into contact, and in many cases have come to trade or otherwise cooperate with each other. Today, more than ever, we depend on people halfway around the world for the goods and services that sustain us, as do those people. In other words, the fates of people around the world have become more and more correlated. That's what interdependence is. And oddly, this correlation is actually strengthened by such global problems as climate change, problems that are bad for people in diverse parts of the world, and whose solution would therefore be good for people in diverse parts of the world. In various different senses, people on different continents are in the same boat. It is in our common interest to work together. What could go wrong? Well, if you're viewing the whole thing up close, answers may spring to mind. Here's the answer that springs to my mind. Groups of people fighting with each other. The lines of battle may be ethnic, religious, national, or ideological, but antagonism seems to have grown along many of these lines in recent years. What's more, there seem to be some dangerous positive feedback loops. Antagonism on one side creates more antagonism on the other, which creates more antagonism on the first side, and so on. This is the kind of dynamic that can fuel a long downward spiral, which would be alarming even if we weren't living in an age of nuclear weapons and increasingly lethal and accessible biological weapons. But we are living in such an age. What's more, we're living in an age when information technologies make it easy for relatively small numbers of people bound by a common enmity to find each other, no matter where on earth they are, and then coordinate to deploy violence. Hatred, even when diffuse and far-flung, has increasingly lethal potential. What causes all the hatred? At some level, it's always the same thing. Human beings operating under the influence of human brains whose design presupposed their specialness. That is, human beings operating under the influence of the reality distortion fields that control us in many and subtle ways, convincing us that we and ours are in the right, that we are by nature good, and that when we do the occasional bad thing, it's not a reflection of the real us, whereas they and theirs aren't in the right and aren't by nature good, and when they do the occasional good thing, it's not a reflection of the real them. And it doesn't help matters that these reality distortion fields often magnify, even out-and-out fabricate, the threat posed by them and theirs. So yes, we need to reject the core evolutionary value of the specialness of self. Indeed, there's probably never been a time in human history when this rejection was more vital. But we don't want to reject what is also, in a sense, a value of natural selections, that the creation and sustenance of sentient life is good. Happily, mindfulness meditation is well suited to fighting that first value while serving the second one. As a bonus, it brings us closer to the truth. You could even view mindfulness meditation itself as, in some sense, a part of the natural unfolding of life, part of the ongoing co-evolutionary process. Maybe, given the constraints under which this universe operates, the only way for complex consciousness to arise on this planet was for it to be warped in the process, distorted by the exaltation of self. And maybe, once social organization approaches the global level, the only way for complex consciousness to flourish on this planet, or even to survive, is for it to now be unwarped, or at least partly unwarped. We can thank Buddhism for laying out a path to this unwarping. Buddhism isn't alone in deserving thanks. Thinkers in many religious and philosophical traditions, from ancient times onward, have in some sense seen the problem and have suggested ways of addressing it, which is good, because it means that many traditions have resources to draw on as humankind confronts its collective challenge. But Buddhism deserves credit for so early, so acutely, and so systematically diagnosing the problem, and for offering such a comprehensive prescription. And now, finally, science has corroborated the diagnosis and revealed its roots. The problem was built into us by our creator, natural selection. Fortunately, natural selection also equipped us with the tools for addressing the problem. Rational and reflective faculties that in principle can transcend the circumstances of their birth. And who knows? Maybe they will. 16. Meditation and the Unseen Order. There were many wonderful things about that first meditation retreat I attended back in the summer of 2003, and there was one not-so-wonderful thing. A song got stuck in my head. When you're on a silent meditation retreat, songs can stay in your head for a really long time, because there's not much input to displace them, and this song was one I don't especially like. It's by Foreigner, a group that had a burst of prominence when I was in college, and it's called Feels Like the First Time. The chorus begins, "And it feels like the first time like it never did before. Feels like the first time, like we've opened up the door. The song was haunting me from early in the retreat, and it proved oddly prophetic. By the end of the retreat, I did feel like a door had opened for the first time. In fact, there was a distinct moment when it felt, almost literally, like a door had opened and I had walked into a strange new place. It happened during the overwhelmingly and vibrantly blissful experience I mentioned in Chapter 4, the one I had while meditating at night amid loudly chanting insects. Though I had my eyes closed, the experience was very visual, and I remember a distinct moment when I felt I'd crossed some threshold and entered a kind of fuzzily defined cavernous room made of orange and purple light. Before I explain what I saw in that room, I need to expand on something I've already mentioned, the fact that I had been kind of hard on myself during this retreat for not being a good meditator. This was actually part of a long-standing pattern. I've always been good at convincing myself that I've made a mistake, at chastising myself for it, and sometimes at pretty literally hating myself for it. For decades, people have told me I shouldn't be like this. They've said things like, "Don't beat yourself up about it." This has always annoyed me. My feeling has been that you should beat yourself up about things you do wrong. Otherwise, you may keep doing them. And let's be honest, isn't one of the big problems with the world how many people do bad things and then don't feel any need for self-chastisement? One thing about meditation teachers that bothered me from the get-go was their frequent insistence that we yogis not be hard on ourselves. This is such a common refrain that I've encountered people who thought, "Don't be hard on yourself," was a core Buddhist teaching, a message that pervades ancient scripture. It's not. Here's a passage from one of the Buddha's discourses. "Monks, true knowledge is the forerunner and the entry upon wholesome states, with a sense of shame and fear of wrongdoing, following along. You will have to look a long time to find a mindfulness meditation teacher in modern America encouraging students to feel shame." But I digress. The experience I had that night wasn't a full-fledged hallucination. As I entered that weird visual space, I didn't lose contact with the real world. I was aware that I was sitting in a meditation hall, and that intense concentration had put my mind in a place it had never been. But where was this place? Only after looking around a bit did I realize that the place my mind had entered was my mind, or at least my mind's representation of my mind. The tip-off was that I saw, and I guess heard, a particular thought I've had many times after doing something arguably stupid or inept or wrong. The thought was, "You screwed up." Actually, "screwed up" is a sanitized version of the phrase I tend to use and of the phrase that constituted the thought I observed that night. Anyway, the main thing is this. I now saw this thought assume a form I had never seen it assume before. Come to think of it, I had never seen this thought assume any form at all. But it now looked as if, literally looked as if, one part of my mind was speaking the thought to another part. There was even a kind of line tracing the path of the message, like an arrow on a diagram indicating the direction of communication. I watched this intracranial conversation, watched the message travel from sender to recipient as a kind of outside observer, even though I thought of the recipient as in some sense being me. It's almost impossible to convey in words the power of this experience and its aura of significance. I felt as if I had been ushered into the inner sanctum, where deep truths are revealed. I don't know how much of this sense of revelation rested on the narcotic caliber bliss that was enveloping me with growing warmth as the experience unfolded. But I assume bliss can be a potent revelation reinforcer. In any event, whatever neurochemicals impart conviction to our apprehensions, making us feel sure we've seen the truth, must have been in liberal supply that night. And what was the truth I was seeing? What struck me at the time was that, for the first time ever, this standard thought of mine, "you screwed up," didn't seem to be coming from me. It was just some guy in my head doing the talking, and it wasn't clear that he was worth paying attention to. Who the hell was he, anyway? Now, more than a decade later, having thought about this stuff more and written this book, I might answer, he was a module in my mind. But at the time, I was thinking less academically, and the lesson seemed to be that in the future, I could treat my inner critic with some critical distance, if not outright disdain. As much as I had resisted entreaties to quit beating myself up, as much as I had minimized the toll it took on me, the prospect of living without this self-torture now seemed powerfully appealing. I'm not much of a crier, but I started crying. I tried to do it quietly, but I did it fully. It wasn't long before the bliss had given way to joyous excitement. I remember how frustrating it was after the session ended, as people strolled silently out of the hall, not to be able to share my epic news with anyone. The news wasn't just about conquering self-loathing. I had a sense that many things that had come only with pain and struggle would now come more easily. I had reached a high spiritual plane, and I had found a technique, meditation, that could get me there again and again. It's hard to reconstruct this experience, but I think this sense of auspicious spiritual attainment had been implicit in my tears. What I know for sure is that the tears were in part tears of gratitude, and that the sense of liberation was massive. And then I lived happily ever after. Actually, no. Another line in that Foreigner song, right after "feels like the very first time," is "like it never will again." And indeed, I haven't had a meditative experience that joltingly powerful since then. My belief that I would be able to access this plane again and again and use it to orchestrate my own personal spiritual renaissance was naive. So was my belief that I would quit beating up on myself, though the frequency and severity of the beatings seemed to have fallen off a bit. I'm not saying I never again realized states of intense bliss when meditating. There have been times on retreat when I could precisely control the flow of bliss entering my being, opening up the spigot or, if I felt a need to pace myself, shutting it off for a minute or two before opening it back up. And I'm certainly not saying that my experience on that summer night in Barre, Massachusetts, didn't in any sense change my life. I'm just saying that this book lacks a common feature of books like this: the author's claim of a single dramatic experience that is enduringly transformative. Clarity begins at home. All of this raises a question. Why do I still meditate? Why do I devote somewhere between 30 and 50 minutes of each day to a practice that will not, apparently, get me very close to enlightenment anytime soon? There are several reasons. I'll start with the little ones. 1. Moments of truth. Imagine a refrigerator making that humming noise that refrigerators make. Sounds monotonous, right? Actually, it's not. When I'm meditating in the morning, if the tabletop refrigerator in my office starts humming, and I've cleared my mind enough to actually pay attention to it, I see that the hum consists of at least three different sounds, each of which varies in intensity and texture over time. This is a truth about the world that is ordinarily hidden from me, but is revealed through an elementary exercise of mindfulness, and it is an objective truth. You could no doubt set up sound-sensing equipment that would depict these three sounds as distinct lines on a graph. This may seem like a trivial truth. In fact, it is a trivial truth. And I have to admit that, strictly speaking, it's not just the truth in this experience that helps keep me coming back to the cushion each day. There's also the pleasantness of the experience. If my mind is clear enough to sense the nuances of the refrigerator's hum, then it is free enough of everyday concerns to see this little three-instrument symphony, this infinitely rich unfolding of pattern, as beautiful, and to feel it as beautiful, sometimes really intensely beautiful. But with all due respect for beauty, I don't want to downplay the truth angle here, the sheer clear perception of a refrigerator's hum, because it's important to realize that even if complete and utter enlightenment will remain remote for most of us. Portions of enlightenment are available. Even if we can't apprehend the truth about all of reality and sustain that apprehension throughout our lives, we can apprehend the truth about little corners of reality and sustain that apprehension for a little while. And here's the key thing. Seeing these little, almost trivial truths on a regular basis in a disciplined way can help us see bigger, less trivial truths, which brings us to the second thing that keeps me meditating. 2. Moments of more consequential truth. If I'm feeling anxiety or dread or hatred, and through meditation I get to a point where I'm just observing the feeling rather than engaging with it, that is a moment of truth. Observing the feeling, after all, involves noting where in my body it resides and what form it assumes there. And that location and form, somewhat like the three separate sounds constituting the refrigerator's hum, is an objective fact. Presumably, there will someday be body scans that give you a 3D display of the physical manifestation of different kinds of feelings. I'm pretty sure the resulting graphs will have roughly the structure of what I'm sensing when I'm observing a given feeling. What's fascinating is how much variation there is in the subjective experience that can accompany the objective fact of this feeling. The more you focus on the objective fact, on the feeling itself and its instantiation in your body, the less unpleasantness you may feel. This is not a trivially easy feat, but it's doable, and it counts in favor of the Buddha's claim that dukkha is in some sense optional, and the way to reduce, if not eliminate it, is to see reality clearly, to see objective facts for what they are, and for no more than what they are. 3. The wisdom of clarity. If, during my morning meditation, I'm tuned in to those three components of my refrigerator's hum, or for that matter, if I'm observing my breath, or some feeling, with great clarity, it means my mind is calm. Not just because if my mind weren't calm, I couldn't see those things so clearly, but also because getting absorbed in the clarity helps calm my mind. And here is an interesting feature of a calm mind. If some issue in my life bubbles up, I'm likely to conceive of it with uncharacteristic wisdom. Suddenly, I see that an email in my outbox, the one with the subtle but discernible edge of annoyance that I made a point to add, since after all, the email I'm responding to was itself annoying, might as well not include that edge of annoyance. No good will come of it, and some bad may come of it. 4. Moments of moral truth. Part of this revised perspective on sending that email may be a revised view of the person I'm sending it to. Indeed, the key to the whole revision may be that I view that person without the antagonism that in a less calm state of mind had accompanied every thought about him. Suddenly, I'm willing to entertain the hypothesis that the annoying email I got from him isn't really proof that he's a jerk. Maybe there's some circumstantial reason he added an annoying edge to the email. Maybe I can guess the reason, maybe I can't. But in any event, who among us hasn't been in a circumstance that led us to do something annoying? In fact, didn't I just come very close to sending an annoying email? 5. Timely interventions. If at 5 or 6 p.m., I'm feeling unsettled or angry or resentful or despondent or anything else that I'd rather not feel, I can sit down on the meditation cushion and observe that feeling and, pretty reliably, make things better. If I wake up at night with anxiety, I can lie there and meditate on the anxiety, and somewhat less reliably, but as often as not, make things better. And sometimes I even perform a feat previously thought, by me at least, impossible. While sitting at the computer, staring at something I'm writing and feeling a painfully strong urge to do anything other than write, I close my eyes, observe the urge until it weakens, and then get back to writing. The reason I can do all these things, And, for that matter, the reason I even remember that doing them is an option is that I'm spending some time on the cushion every morning. The same goes for not beating up on myself. The more time on the cushion, the fewer eruptions of self-chastisement. The slippery slope toward enlightenment. So there. That's five reasons I keep meditating, even though I don't harbor serious hopes that this path will lead all the way to enlightenment. At least, that's one way you could put it. Another way you could put it is that I am pursuing enlightenment. It's just that, rather than think of enlightenment as a state, I think of it as a process. And I think of liberation from dukkha, in the same way. The object of the game isn't to reach liberation and enlightenment, with a capital L and E, on some distant day, but rather to become a bit more liberated and a bit more enlightened on a not-so-distant day. Like today. Or, failing that, tomorrow. Or the next day. Or whenever. The main thing is to make net progress over time, inevitable backsliding notwithstanding. Thinking about enlightenment and liberation this way helps drive home how subtle the relationship between truth and freedom can be. One common and not-so-subtle conception of this relationship is that you see the truth in a flash of insight, and then you are free. Sounds great, and what a time-saver. But I don't think it happens very often that the truth sets you free, period. Sometimes it's the other way around. Freedom lets you see the truth. Remember, part of what let me see the truth about that refrigerator hum and about my email correspondent is that my mind was calm, not in the grips of anxiety or rage or any other major source of dukkha. Maybe the best way to put it is that enlightenment and liberation are mutually reinforcing. The more you do the things that bring liberation from suffering, the more clearly you see. And the more clearly you see, the easier it is to do things that bring liberation from suffering, which allows even more clarity of vision, and so on. For example, suppose you start out with a modest meditative practice that's more about self-help than spiritual attainment. 20 minutes a day of mindfulness-based stress reduction. Suppose this does, as advertised, reduce stress. Being free or freer of stress is by definition liberating, even if you're not thinking of it that way. It's also enlightening. After all, if you're not stressed out, you're less likely to label someone a jerk just because he's at a checkout counter fumbling for his credit card and you're behind him and in a hurry. That little bit of progress, seeing a bit less essence of jerk in someone who is doing something you've done yourself, is a little bit of enlightenment. What's more, this little bit of enlightenment can lead to more bits of liberation that then lead to more bits of enlightenment. If seeing less essence of jerk in people, and thus spending less time fulminating pointlessly, further reduces the amount of stress in your life, maybe this effect will be so gratifying, so liberating, that it encourages you to meditate for 25 minutes a day instead of 20. And that leads to more liberation from stress, which further clarifies your view of other people. Now you're tolerant not just of people who fumble with credit cards, but of people who fumble with them and then drop them on the floor. Congratulations! Your meditation sessions don't have to be all that long before it becomes obvious that stress reduction can be more interesting than it sounds. It isn't just that you feel a little more relaxed by the end of a meditation session. It's that you observe your anxiety or your fear or your hatred or whatever so mindfully that for a moment you see it as not being part of you. Note how profound, or at least incrementally profound, these experiences are. To see less essence of jerk in a credit card fumbler is to experience, in very small measure, emptiness. And to see your anxiety or fear as not being part of you is to experience a tiny bit of not-self. These two ideas, emptiness and not-self, are two of the most arcane, most crazy-sounding, and most fundamental ideas in Buddhist philosophy. And here you are, meditating each day for the sake of stress reduction and apprehending both, at least in some measure. I don't want to make this sound easy. Though incremental enlightenment and incremental liberation can gather momentum via mutual assistance, it's not as if they're automatically self-sustaining. There are obstacles, and they can be frustrating, and meditation can be a pain. The good news is that the pain can lead to gain if you hang in there, if you don't shrink from anxiety or sadness, but instead observe them mindfully, if you don't give up on a morning's sitting in the face of restless boredom, but instead observe it mindfully, which, oddly, can be harder than observing anxiety or sadness mindfully. I'll never forget something that Narayan said on my first meditation retreat. Boredom can be interesting. It's true, but seeing its truth will involve first spending some time absorbing another truth. Boredom can be really boring, and persisting in the face of it. Maybe the biggest impediment to continued meditative progress is the unfortunate finiteness of time. If you have much in the way of responsibilities, a job, kids to rear, school to attend, whatever, you can't devote huge chunks of each day to meditation. And in my own experience, the difference between 30 minutes a day and 50 minutes a day is big. And in the experience of people I've talked to, the difference between 30 minutes a day and 90 is huge. But even if you're down near the 20-minute end of the spectrum, your practice can have depth. And that's especially true if you keep in mind the basic take-home lesson of Buddhist meditative philosophy. Those little moments of truth you're getting each day, at least that you're getting on a good day, are pieces of a bigger truth, a truth about the nature of reality and about the distortions, even delusions, imposed by our default perception of it. Sure, it would be great if you attained enlightenment and spent all your life feeling that big truth. But even if you can't, even if you have to work to bring that truth intermittently to mind, it can be a guiding truth. Saving the world through clarity. Okay, so that's much of the argument I'd make if people who don't meditate ask me why they should meditate. I talk about lots of little moments of truth, and how cultivating these moments can turn someone into a happier, better person. But this doesn't really get at the heart of the reason I hope more people will meditate. What motivated me to write this book isn't just the prospect of sprinkling little moments of truth into the lives of receptive readers, or even to convey the larger, guiding truth these moments point to. What motivated me to write this book is the idea of a moment of truth, in the singular. Merriam-Webster's Collegiate Dictionary defines a moment of truth as a moment of crisis on whose outcome much or everything depends. I don't think that's too strong a phrase for the planetary challenge I described in the previous chapter, the problem of ethnic, religious, national, and ideological conflict that can feed on itself, creating a spiral of growing hatred that leads to true catastrophe. Suggesting that meditation can help save the world is a good way to get written off as hopelessly naive. So let me stress that the idea here isn't to generate a worldwide wave of loving-kindness. I mean, that would be great, but I don't think it's going to happen anytime soon, and I don't think the salvation of the world requires it. I think the salvation of the world can be secured via the cultivation of calm, clear minds and the wisdom they allow. Such minds can, for one thing, keep us from overreacting to threats and thus from feeding the vicious circles that intensify conflicts. Calm, clear minds can also help us soberly assess what animates the threats and so figure out, for example, what kinds of things encourage people to join or support violent causes, and what kinds of things discourage them from doing that. We don't have to love our enemies, but seeing them clearly is essential. And one lesson from both Buddhist philosophy and modern psychology is that seeing them clearly involves dialing down the fear and loathing, but also more than that. It involves transcending much subtler distortions of perception and cognition, often distortions that are grounded in subtler feelings. This clarity of vision doesn't have to suddenly envelop the world. Even isolated pockets of equanimity and wisdom can make a difference and can prepare the ground for their own expansion. As with individual progress toward enlightenment, global progress toward enlightenment can be incremental and yet, through commitment, can acquire a momentum of its own. That said, I think there are going to have to be a whole lot of increments. In fact, I think there will have to be, in the long run, a revolution in human consciousness. I'm not sure what to call the revolution, maybe the metacognitive revolution, since it will involve stepping back and becoming more aware of how our minds work. But I think it's going to have to be something so dramatic that future historians will have an actual label for the transformation. Assuming there are future historians, and if there aren't, that will probably mean there was no successful transformation to label anyway. Near the outset of this book, I anointed myself a laboratory rat. I said that if I could get much in the way of benefits out of meditation, just about anybody could, because I am peculiarly ill-suited to calming down and focusing. Well, the results are in. Just about anybody can benefit from meditation. But those aren't all the results. The question I originally asked wasn't just whether I could get enough benefits from meditation to keep returning to the cushion every day, or even whether I could, to some extent, clarify my day-to-day moral vision. I also asked whether I could meet the particular moral challenge that centrally motivated the writing of this book, overcoming, or at least eroding, the psychology of tribalism. As I noted, along this dimension, I am an especially valuable laboratory rat because, with all due humility, I so powerfully exemplify the problem. In a way, it's odd that I would be so tribalistic. I don't have a strong version of the most famously dangerous tribal allegiances, ethnic, religious, national. Maybe that's why I focus so much emotional energy on tribal boundaries defined by opinion, why I strongly identify with people who agree with me and am capable of thinking somewhat unflattering things about people who disagree with me, which goes double or triple when the disagreement is about ideology, about policies that should or shouldn't be adopted. Here's an embarrassing irony. Nothing so arouses tribalistic animosities in me as people who support policies that, in my view, tend to arouse tribalistic animosities. To take just one example, I think most American military interventions of the past couple of decades have been mistakes, examples of overreacting to threats and thereby exacerbating them. And the people who have most strongly supported these interventions drive me nuts. And I want them to keep driving me kind of nuts. I wouldn't want to travel so far down the path toward nirvana that I was drained of fighting spirit. If full-on enlightenment means you quit making value judgments of any kind and quit pushing for change, then count me out. But believe me when I tell you that getting to that point in the path is not, for me at least, a looming peril. The question is whether I can get far enough down the path to conduct my ideological combat with these people wisely and truthfully, which in turn means viewing them more objectively and, in a sense, more generously than I'm naturally inclined to do. The answer is that I think meditation has, at a minimum, helped me move closer to this goal. But it's a struggle. When I exhort people to advance the metacognitive revolution by overcoming the cognitive biases that sustain tribalism, I can't hold myself up as one of the world's more compelling role models. The other thing I don't claim is that I have a step-by-step plan for the revolution. My main point is more abstract. It would be tragic, to say the least, if after billions of years of arduous effort on the part of organic life, effort that has gotten us to the verge of a global community of minds, we let the natural distortions in these minds blow the whole thing apart. It would be all the more tragic in light of the fact that these distortions are now a scientifically established fact, and that we have ways of correcting them, including, though not confined to, meditative practice. All I'm really saying is this: the means to the planet's salvation is at hand. Speaking of salvation, in my conjectures as to why I cried at that meditation retreat, I left out one possibly relevant thing. I was brought up religiously as a Southern Baptist. I started drifting away from the church as a teenager after comparing the theory of natural selection with the Book of Genesis as accounts of how humans came to be. I've never felt a desperate yearning for something that would replace my Christian faith, but presumably the loss of it left a vacancy somewhere inside me, or that may account for my enduring interest in spiritual questions. On that summer night in Barrie, maybe I didn't just feel like I'd gotten to the mountaintop. Maybe I felt like I'd been climbing that mountain since I was a teenager and left my native spiritual tribe. In any event, I don't think it's overstating the case to say that on that night I had a feeling of salvation, a feeling that may have been as powerful as the feeling that impelled me, at age 9 or 10, to walk to the front of the church during the minister's invitation and accept Jesus as my Savior. My departure from Christianity wasn't a bitter one, as some such departures are. I never felt that faith had damaged me. I guess, come to think of it, growing up with an ever-watchful and pretty strict God could help account for my acute and sometimes painful attention to my shortcomings. Indeed, maybe some residual sense of sinfulness is what drove me to embark on this whole exploration of Buddhist meditation. And maybe it's the reason the sense of salvation on that summer night was palpable. That would stand to reason. Both Buddhism and Christianity say that at birth we inherit a kind of moral confusion, the dispelling of which is one object of the game. In any event, I've never felt that my Christian years were some kind of brutal authoritarian brainwashing. I still love the Baptist hymns, notably, Just As I Am, a song often sung softly at the end of the service to accompany the invitation. The song's message is basically that, though you're far from perfect, you're worthy of salvation. My most vivid memory of Sunday school is a good one, of singing, Jesus loves the little children, all the children of the world, red and yellow, black and white, they are precious in his sight. Jesus loves the little children of the world. Maybe I've selectively remembered the more enlightened parts of Christian ethics, but the Jesus to Buddha transition does seem in some ways a natural one. The Insight Meditation Society, the place where my mind opened up before my very eyes on that summer night, happens to reinforce this continuity. Before being purchased by Goldstein, Salzburg, and Cornfield, the red brick building that houses the society had been a novitiate, a place where Catholic priests trained. As you walk from the cloakroom toward the meditation hall, there are on either side of you stained glass windows with images of Jesus, one of him at the Last Supper and one of him praying intently, presumably shortly before the crucifixion. Every time I walk into that meditation hall, and I've now done so hundreds of times, I look at those images of Jesus. They pretty reliably give me some uplift, which is apt, because Jesus said that our perception of the world is distorted, and that we should work on correcting our blind spots rather than complain about the blind spots of others. You hypocrite, first take the log out of your own eye, and then you will see clearly to take the speck out of your neighbor's eye. Amen to that. I don't call myself a Buddhist because traditional Buddhism has so many dimensions of belief, of ritual, that I haven't adopted. I don't believe in reincarnation or related notions of karma, and I don't bow before the statue of the Buddha upon entering the meditation hall, much less pray to him or to any Buddhist deities. Calling myself a Buddhist, it seems to me, would almost be disrespectful to the many Buddhists in Asia and elsewhere who inherited and sustain a rich and beautiful religious tradition. Still, it's fair to ask, especially given my personal history, whether my meditation practice, along with the philosophy that undergirds it, qualifies as a religion. Does it do the kinds of things Christianity did for my parents, even though I've jettisoned the supernatural parts of Buddhism, and indeed retained the naturalistic parts a bit selectively? Is secular Buddhism a religion? If you were hoping to make that case, one person to turn to would be William James, who, more than a century ago, in his book Varieties of Religious Experience, tried to find a framework that would encompass all the forms of experience, Eastern and Western, that we call religious. James said that, in the broadest sense, religion can be thought of as the belief that there is an unseen order and that our supreme good lies in harmoniously adjusting ourselves thereto. Even naturalistic, secular Buddhism does, I'd argue, posit a kind of unseen order. As enlightenment begins to dawn, reality, which had seemed all chopped up, turns out to possess an underlying continuity, a kind of infrastructure of interconnection. Some people call it emptiness, others call it unity, but all agree that it looks less sharply fragmented than it looked before they got the picture. And what James called our supreme good does lie in harmoniously adjusting ourselves to this normally unseen order, regardless of whether you think of this supreme good as being our deepest happiness or our virtue. Of course, part of this adjustment of ourselves means thinking of ourselves as being less substantial, or at least less distinctly substantial, than we might have previously thought ourselves to be. Indeed, this diffuseness of the self and this porousness of the bounds of self are part of the unseen order, a newly perceived continuity between what's inside of us and what's outside of us. There's also a second kind of unseen order posited by Buddhist teaching. Remember, a basic premise of Buddhism is that seeing the metaphysical truth, seeing the way things really are, both on the inside and the outside, and hence seeing the continuity between those two zones, in some sense amounts to seeing the moral truth, the moral equivalence between our welfare and the welfare of others. There is, in other words, a kind of structural alignment between metaphysical truth and moral truth. That's a kind of order, an order that can remain unseen if we don't practice the disciplines that make it manifest. This unseen order is not something we should take for granted. You can imagine a universe in which there is no such alignment, a universe in which seeing the metaphysical truth has no effect on your conduct toward other beings, or even inclines you to treat other beings more unkindly. But according to Buddhism, even the Western, more secular version of Buddhism, sometimes held to be insufficiently religious, we live in a universe in which seeing the metaphysical truth helps you see the moral truth. There is a natural unity of enlightenment. Then there's the third leg of this alignment, our well-being. Happiness, the elimination or at least lessening of suffering, of unsatisfactoriness, of dukkha, tends to coincide with seeing the metaphysical truth and acting on the attendant moral truth. This, too, is a kind of alignment that, presumably, a universe doesn't have to have. It's kind of amazing, when you think about it, that the world would be set up this way, that the path you embark on to relieve yourself of suffering would, if pursued assiduously, lead you to become not just a happier person, but a person with a clearer view of both metaphysical and moral reality. Yet that is the Buddhist claim, and there is substantial evidence in favor of it. This three-part alignment, the alignment of metaphysical truth and moral truth and happiness, is embodied in the richly ambiguous word that lies at the heart of Buddhist practice, Dharma. This ancient word is most commonly defined as the Buddha's teaching. That's accurate insofar as it goes, but the word also refers to the core truths that are being conveyed by the Buddha's teaching. Dharma, thus denotes the reality that lies beyond our delusions, and for that matter, the reality about how those delusions